Hello and welcome to the Remarkable podcast.
Oh, okay. So we've now run out of like real words beginning with Mark, and now we're
the middle words spell Mark. Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah.
Oh, well, a whole new adjectival world has opened up to us.
Yeah, there's so many different options for us now. But to start things off on this whole new point, breaking news: Blythe, Vladimir Putin was reelected.
Get out. No
chance.
Yeah,
I know. Big surprise. That big surprise.
Shocking.
But huge numbers for him. 67% turnout, 77% of the vote. So go Putin. I mean, legitimate numbers, you know, really, really racked it up.
Well, this is the thing about Putin in many ways, is that you kind of have to see it from the point of view of Russia over the past, you know, two or three decades. So since the end of the Cold War, they lost 40% of GDP. Male life expectancy collapsed from, I think, 71 to like 59 or something incredible.
Jeez,
like this.
Wow.
And has barely recovered. The country hemorrhaged money, became incredibly unequal through asset seizures, bogus privatizations, and gangsterism. I mean, basically, the country was run by gangsters.
Yeah.
So in comes the tough sheriff, right? And he cleans up. He then puts in his protege. Right. And then basically the global financial crisis notwithstanding, and they had big reserves to cushion the slump on that, and even the slump in oil sales, they've actually been doing reasonably okay, even despite sanctions. So guess what? About 60% of people think he's doing a pretty good job.
Yeah.
We've still got 40% of people thinking Trump's doing a good job. So
yes,
we can't be too surprised about that one.
Well, I saw some just interviews on the street, and young Russians, when they were asked who they were going to vote for, they all said, of course, Putin. That's the only person they know. But they were also really supportive. So I was surprised that the younger voters were so supportive of him.
Well, again, let's think about it from the point of view of, let's say, Britain, right? So,
yeah,
you know, Britain every now and again sort of still thinks it's a world power. and the incident with the chemical warfare being unleashed on your territory, they still seem to have a very effective diplomatic network. The fact that you can get the Americans on board with this stuff, despite all of the complexities of Trump's relationship with Russia, you can get the EU to stand up to them, and there's been, you know, mass expulsions of all these spies all over the place. But at the end of the day, Britain isn't really a big, powerful country. Right. And Russia isn't really a big and powerful country as much as it pretends as well. So you kind of have this kind of, I don't know, battling midgets contest, right, on the global stage. And the one that really matters is the US, and the US really can't be annoyed by the whole thing.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's a bit murky and a bit messy, to say the least.
What was interesting to me is when Theresa May expelled the spies. I mean, it seems like such a non-move in some ways. I mean, I don't know what that does, except just to sort of tell Russia they're kind of annoyed.
Right. And when everybody else jumps in and does the same thing, and then Russia does the same thing back, I mean, essentially, it's everyone's poking each other in the one good eye they've got left so they can see less.
I mean, there was talk of of the government actually putting limits on the Russian money coming in to buy places in Mayfair.
But yeah, that'll never happen.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
I mean, come on. One of Britain's greatest strengths is its money laundering capacity through the City of London property market. We believe in free markets. We can't let that go on.
Free markets. Something else that was really powerful on a totally different track was the March for Our Lives, organized by the Parkland students. I think that was now a couple weeks ago. And it was interesting to see the effect that they've been having. Laura Ingraham, one of the very popular talk show hosts, took on one of the students and now has lost a ton of advertisers, for example. And the kid wouldn't accept her apology. I thought that was an interesting development. I also was reading, and there were two different strains of this that I really appreciated. And one that was that these are all white kids, like white middle class, upper middle class kids, and that the media really liked them. And this is one of the reasons why they're getting so much traction, in direct comparison to the African-American kids around the Black Lives Matter and how they've been called terrorists, if not worse. And really thinking about that juxtaposition between these two groups of young people.
Absolutely. So the Sacramento killing, you know, is the latest example of what has driven Black Lives Matter to the forefront of attention. And there you have someone who seems to be, and then there's is that the guy who had his pants down, or is that the one who was shot in his grandma's back garden?
Grandma
right.
Beck,
and then you've got a guy who's got his pants down his ankles, right? What possible threat can he be showing? Wallop, you get shot. These killings are happening primarily in African-American communities, right? Mm-hmm. So you've got a mobilized social movement that said, hey, you know, this is really happening to us. Then it happens in sort of like the, if you will, the nightmare mm-hmm. of sort of the white middle classes, which is like their kids' school. And then it gets attention. And suddenly, you know, this is about gun control, yeah. finally, in a way that was never possible. Yes. When it was just those kids.
Yeah, and it becomes about mental health issues when, in fact, when it, this happens in predominantly African-American or Latino-Hispanic neighborhoods, it's never about mental health issues.
Oh, absolutely. It's,
I mean, the finger always is pointed to the parents or, you know, all of those different stereotypes that are often associated.
Actually, someone sent me a piece, I think it was from The Lancet, from one of the medical journals, that actually looks into the link between mental health and gun violence. Mm-hmm. There isn't one.
Oh, there isn't?
No, basically, when you look at the aggregate numbers, because numbers are huge, yeah. right? You'll get one or two high profile cases. Like, so the Denver shooter who dressed up as, you know, Batman or whatever it was, right? But they are totally out of sample. Most of these happen in the home with family members, people who are not mental, etc., yeah. etc. Yeah. So the whole thing's a ruse, essentially, to divert attention from the fact that it's not really mental cases who are doing this stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and it also changes the policy problem definition that it's not about guns, it's somehow about mental health.
Right, exactly. So you don't ban guns, what you do is you ban mental people. I don't see how that one works.
Yeah. Yeah. Related somewhat in terms of mental people, Cambridge Analytica.
Oh, yes. Yes. Getting into the mental bits of people.
Well, Facebook under a lot of fire for using the data. Is it that Cambridge sent them the data or Facebook used it? I can't remember. What are the
the
arrows?
So there's a whistleblower. The whistleblower is this Canadian guy who came out of nowhere. He was talking to The Guardian and he's now become sort of chief witness for mm-hmm. the prosecution. And he has all these documents that essentially show, arguably, I haven't seen them, I don't know, that they said that they deleted data that they'd got for academic purposes. They mm-hmm. weaponized it for commercial purposes. They kept the data. They built on it, extrapolated it from that. Rather than just the one person that took the test, that enabled them to tap 150 other profiles from the friends that they know. So, you know, guess what? It turns out that if you go to a computer site and you give up your rights to your information and you post every picture you've got and you tell everyone what you like and what you don't like and what sucks and what doesn't suck, somebody's going to take notice and they're going to use that. The fact that anyone is in the least bit surprised by this is amazing.
And you look at all of the polls for Americans about surveillance and but 70% of Americans do not care about the surveillance state. It's so surprising to me that no one, and that you're right, we post every single thing about what we eat down to like the finest details of our lives, and somehow we're surprised that people are taking notice and using this data.
Absolutely. So I watched a talk recently from a guy whose name is, I forget now, he's an NYU business prof. And you can get it on YouTube. It's incredible. He wrote a book called The Big Four. Mm-hmm. And, you know, about Amazon, Apple, etc.
Oh, yeah.
Right? And it's this amazing half-hour talk he's got on YouTube where he basically starts off by saying the following. Imagine you've got an Alexa speaker in your house.
Mm-hmm.
Just all the stuff that you talk about.
Yeah.
When you argue with your partner, when you go nuts at your kids, right? Oh, it's switched off all the time, isn't it? Right.
Yeah.
Let's think about every time you've had a twinge in your back and you thought, oh no, that's it, I've got leukemia, right? Mm-hmm. And you ran to the computer and checked it up. That's all there. It's all traceable. This thing is your physician. This thing is your lawyer.
Yeah.
This thing is your risk taker. What about the time when you thought about having an affair and you looked at that dodgy website, right?
Yeah.
Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All of that is there. You're not concerned about this? Imagine if one person you knew all that about that. You would be extremely upset if they knew all that about you.
Well, this is why I'm not getting one. But also, this is not get too nerdy, but this is like Battlestar Galactica. You had the one ship that is not, you know,
it's not connected. Right.
And then they're able to do, but I mean, are we all, is this what we're all becoming, is tethered to some large mothership? And I mean, this is what kind of makes me laugh is people who are now deleting their Facebook accounts. Like, come on, this like, it has no effect.
Absolutely.
All of this stuff has already been collected on you in some way, shape, or form. So I have a academic interest in the census. And so all of the headlines around the census and that the Department of Commerce, which runs the census, is now going to ask this question about whether the individual answering the questionnaire is a citizen. And I thought the census has been used in so many nefarious ways in the past around Japanese internment. They first started asking questions about Mexicans and they called them Mexicans in the 1910 census. And for enumerators, the people who actually collect the data, they said, you will know a Mexican by where they work. So, I mean, this was, and they were working at the border essentially. So this has been used in the Chinese Exclusion Act of 18 in the late 1800s. I mean, it's used in so many different ways. This is not the first time it's been used as a political, mm-hmm. in some sort of politicized way. And then also thinking that the government knows all this data, but whether you're a citizen, like whether you are Muslim, whether you're Arab, whether you're Chinese, like all of this stuff.
Well, look, you've also posted it on Facebook.
Yes, exactly. Right? I mean, you know, underwear
there's
you're
so much data out there. Like the addition of this one thing, it's kind of weird. I mean, maybe it's all this, you know, last remnant of the belief that there is a kind of technocratic part of the state which is nonpartisan, which, you know, we can trust. Whether it's the FDA with drugs, right?
Yeah,
you know, this is Dan Carpenter's book on that subject, right? Or whether it's, you know, let's see, who else? NASA, maybe, right? You know, might be sort of, you know, sort of beyond reproach. Yeah. And the census, you want to think, is one of those things. So the minute they seem to start doing something political, it's like, oh, there's another institution corrupted, right? Yeah. But as you point out, you know, they've been at it for a long time.
I mean, can we talk about racial eugenics in the early 18th? I mean, they were using all these categories to try to measure how much black blood people have. So I just think, and this is not to dismiss the power of this question, but the census has always been politicized in so many ways.
The whole point of it, I mean, people, you know, let's think about this for a minute, right? Why do you have a census? You have a census beginning with, you know, well, it's the biblical census, of course, but, you know, the first modern one is probably the Doomsday Book in Britain, mm-hmm. in the mm-hmm. end of the 9th century. So go off and find out how many people are here and, you know, where they all are and, you know, and do the Norman Conquest update of that. And why are you doing that? So you can tax them.
Yes, that's exactly
the foundation of modern macroeconomics is a guy called William Petty, who was Oliver Cromwell's assessor for Ireland. And he took a team over to Ireland and basically counted all the natives, mm-hmm. how many cows they had, mm-hmm. where they lived, mapped it all out. Yeah. Why? So that they could tax them, right? So, you know, if that's not an explicitly political objective, what do you think this is for?
Yes, did he make it into Hilary Mantel's book about Cromwell?
I don't know, actually. Fascinating character, though.
Yeah, sounds very interesting. He needs a book written about him, nonetheless. I was looking at this as there's more turnover in the White House, and we've talked a lot about this. So
Did you do the numbers?
Yes,
did you figure
we
out?
Used on it. So I looked it up. So Trump has a 43% turnover rate. The next closest president is Clinton at 38% turnover, and George W. Bush at 33%. So Trump is the highest.
It's the highest, but I mean, it's not an order of magnitude higher, is it?
Clinton was pretty high, actually, at 38%. Yeah.
So if you then think about, let's say, this over the longer period, over mm-hmm. a four-year term, right? Let's say there's a whole spate of, you know, shuffling the deck chairs just now, and then it calms down. Well, over that whole period, he might drop to 38%
or
below.
Yeah, that's right.
We just don't know at this point.
Yeah.
The most interesting one, of course, for me is the appointment of John Bolton.
Yes,
to the
surprising
NSA.
Choice.
Well, I mean, for multiple reasons. I mean, first of all, a lot of the resonance that Trump had with communities was by standing up in communities where people are predominantly going into the military and saying Iraq was a terrible idea.
Mm-hmm.
And drain the swamp, right? All mm-hmm. these same people who make these mistakes, they've got no skin in the game, they never pay for their mistakes. You know, why are we just voting for them time after time? And that was a really strong resonant mm-hmm. message. And, you know, in a sense, Bolton exemplifies that.
He does.
So, you know, you've got the guy who was the chief Iraq booster who, to mm-hmm. this day, says everything went fine, basically.
Yes, yep.
And we know that he's not just an Iran hawk. He's basically spoiling for round two.
Yes.
So we have North Korea on the horizon for the end of the summer of the mm-hmm. talks don't go well. Mm-hmm. And now we've got Iraq in a showdown with Iraq. The Europeans are desperate to avoid a split over the deal mm-hmm. with Iran, I should say. And now we've got Iran coming up. I always get the two of them confused. I'm saying Iraq and I mean Iran, right? What I mean, right? So you've got North Korea on the one hand and then you've got Iran on the other hand. And we've now, you know, got people ready to fight in both corners. That doesn't sound too good.
Well, and Bolton is kind of Mr. America First. I mean, he was Mr. before anyone thought of that term. I mean, so it shouldn't be a surprise that he's his choice.
Right. But there's another way of looking at this, which is, go back to your, what was it, 43%?
Yeah.
Right. How many NSC chairs has there been already?
I think there's been two.
Right. This is the third one.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So who's to say he's not going to last more than 6 months?
Yeah. Yes.
I mean, at this point, we just don't know. The problem with the trend, there's a great phrase in finance for this, the trend is your friend till it stops.
Yeah.
Right. And then that's, you know, that's kind of one way of looking
but
at that
he
one.
But isn't he run out of people? At some point, Wilby has to be his NSA advisor?
I'm holding out for that. Okay. I'm holding out for basically Treasury once, you know, Mnuchin goes.
Yeah, and you and your wife can hold up the dollar bills.
Oh, yeah, can't wait for that. Like, come on, honey, put on the 4-inch designer stilettos and hold up the dollars, because that doesn't look vulgar. No, it really doesn't. listen, full faith and credit. That's what that says to me every single time.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen that picture, by the way, just Google it. It's amazing.
Yes, it is. It's outstanding.
She's Scottish, you know.
She is? Yeah. Really?
She's from Edinburgh.
Really?
Yeah.
Does she have an accent?
I don't know. I've never heard her speak. Oh. But she's actually from Edinburgh. I've never heard her speak. Exactly. Well, it's like Jared Kushner. Nobody's ever heard him speak.
No, it's supposed to be a whisper.
Maybe none of them speak. Have we ever considered this? Donald speaks a lot, right? There's a reason he hires people who don't speak. This makes sense.
Yeah. I'm deep into Westworld right now. I don't know if I should reveal that, but it's about robots. So maybe they're all robots, like in Westworld. Like, I could believe that.
I remember the original with Yul Brynner.
Yes.
That was actually a great film, 1976. Yes,
it was a movie. Yeah.
Oh, interesting. Anything else we want to cover? Oh, other thing that happened.
Yes.
Tariffs.
Still doing
the same. We've normalized tariffs already.
128 different products, from wine to pork, the Chinese are going to put on our products.
Right, but it's only $3 billion in value, whereas we've numbed them for basically an entire industry.
Yeah.
The big play here is actually Germany. So the entire European growth model is, let's export cars from Germany to everywhere else.
Yeah.
And the Spanish and the Italians and the rest of them can mire themselves in sort of like a half recovery. And basically Trump has got this in his sights and said, no, this is going to stop. And apparently in the German press, there's reports of sort of existential angst in the German business community because they're like, this is all we've got. Mm-hmm. If we have to actually focus on domestic consumption, we're doomed, right? So there's a great deal of, you know, vulnerability into this. Now, you know, you think this is sort of angry old grandpa, you know, flashing around, whatever, right? My friend Brendan Greeley has some really interesting stuff on this, which is if you look at capacity measures of an industry over time, it basically tells you how much of that stuff you make and how many people are employed. Mm-hmm. And the minute China joins the WTO, entire industries in the United States basically collapse, right? And employment numbers just plummet, right? Yeah. So it's going somewhere else, clearly. Now, is tariffs the answer to bringing that back? No, that's nonsense. But you've lost steel, you're losing aluminum, you've lost paper, you've lost toys, you've lost furniture, blah, 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 right? Do you want to lose aircraft?
I see.
Do you want to lose tech?
Yeah.
Because ultimately, the more that China upgrades, if it just continues to do the same thing, which is we can produce at a lower cost than you and our quality is rising, that will happen. Mm-hmm. And if you're quite happy basically being the obverse of another economy's demand shifts, but if you actually basically want to control your destiny in some way, whether it's tariffs or not, that stuff's on the agenda for real. The idea that Europe can run a permanent surplus against the rest of the world and we just have to absorb the deficits, then they have the temerity to tell us off for being in debt. You know, there's something there that's kind of stinky.
So we can expect that the Chinese cars that currently are not at all high, we would never put an Audi in a Chinese car next to each other, is that that's coming at us as a very high quality.
Or more a question of, you know, right now GM produces one in every 10 cars in China and Volkswagen produces a similar number, perhaps even more. But over time, through domestic transfers of technology, et cetera, of course, they want to do their own stuff. And quite reasonably, they want to do their own stuff. But when that happens, if they're able to do it in such a way that basically GM becomes unprofitable in the same way that steel becomes unprofitable, if they start making airplanes in the way that basically Boeing goes, that's a huge problem for the United States, one way or another.
Well, and as you said, Europe, I mean, those are the only two people.
That's it.
Yep.
So it may not be a question of, you know, unfair trade, but the notion of sort of some sense of balance across the system actually needs to be addressed.
Certainly, I'm sure that the Pope will address this.
And that's a nice segue. How did we get to the Pope?
Wasn't it? Does hell exist or does it not exist?
Well, being a Catholic from way back, having read Aquinas on this one, having read Augustine's City of God, the Confessions, I can tell you, I have absolutely no idea.
Oh, okay.
I don't know. Apparently what the Pope said was the following. It was a conversation with a journalist, and he basically said, which has been said by many Catholic theologians, no, it's really kind of absence of God. You don't get to basically join the next life and join the next world. You kind of cease to exist as a soul, which is very different from, you know, big pointy sticks and hellfire and brimstone and all the rest of it. So apparently some curate came out and said, or someone in the curia came out and said, no, it's a real place. It really is a real place. In which case, I want to Google map it. I want to actually know. I want if it's a real place, it has to be on Google Maps, right? Yeah. So they know that's it. And hell has to have a Facebook page.
Yes.
right? You know that, like, Satan, Lucifer's got to have one somewhere. So
for sure, Twitter already.
Exactly. Yeah. Where's exactly Beelzebub's tweets?
Yes.
At Beelzebub.burn.
Exactly. Right? And we, of course, know then what his preferences or her preferences
or
would
her
be
preferences
for, you know, clothing, food, you know, do they Uber Eats? I don't know. Uber or Lyft. Yeah.
Buy sulfur. That would be my one. Definitely. Right.
That's
there.
That's right. Thank you all for listening. We will be back in a couple weeks.